in digital control, and massive investment in infrastructure, notably the giant battery factory outside Reno, not to mention its Edison-like visionary leader, suggest Tesla has the potential to bust out of its specialty niche and become a mass-market player. Tesla's first volume production car, the Model S, swept the industry awards, garnering the first ever unanimous selection as Motor Trend's Car of the Year. The highest scoring car Consumer Reports ever tested, the Car of the Century by Car and Driver, and the Most Important Car Ever by Top Gear. In 2015, it was the highest selling plug-in electric car in the United States, despite selling for twice the price of its competitors. The car that has the potential to turn Tesla into an automobile powerhouse is the forthcoming Model 3. Starting at $35,000, it registered 325,000 reservations, requiring a refundable $1,000 deposit, within a week of its announcement. Few firms get access to $325 million in capital for a year at zero borrowing cost. This is a horseman-grade achievement around storytelling. Still, quite a few variables stand between Tesla today and becoming a fifth horseman at some point in the future. Indeed, the company faces challenges beyond those faced by traditional auto companies, as it needs to set up vast networks of charging stations, service stations, where backlogs are an issue, set up global distribution, deal with an array of government subsidies and expectations for electric cars, and manage regulators in the back pocket of the auto industry. However, what appear now to be obstacles could end up being the type of analog moats that sustain a giant. Tesla does as well as any current company against the T algorithm. Compare Tesla to our criteria. Its product is unparalleled in quality and technical innovation. Tesla is not just an electric car. It's a better car across several dimensions, including a massive and beloved touchscreen-based dashboard, over-the-air software updates, big data and AI, an industry-leading autopilot mode, and design touches, like rethought door handles, that customers love. Tesla controls the customer experience in a way that no other car company has done, or will be able to do without radical and costly changes. Automobile firms fail the vertical test, as they have pursued a capital-light strategy with independently owned dealerships that are time machines. Visiting one is a trip to 1985. These entrenched third-party dealer networks, the limited ability to modify or enhance the vehicle after it has left the factory, and an industry focus on moving the steel off the lot have created a gulf between car companies and consumers. Tesla's most revolutionary change to the auto industry is not its electric engine. Everyone is building those, but its proximity to the customer. From Musk's live-streamed product announcements, to their owned dealerships, to the regular over-the-air product updates, Tesla understands that a $50,000 to $100,000 purchase is the start of a multi-year relationship with Tesla, not John Elway's Claremont Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram. If Tesla can maintain quality customer support in the face of its rapid growth, Tesla's superior repeat customer rates will become a static part of the story that enables access to cheap capital, which will provide resources to enhance the customer experience, increasing repeat purchases, and so on and so on. Tesla trades now at 9x revenue versus Ford and GM at less than 0.5x. In April 2017, Tesla surpassed Ford in market value despite selling 80,000 cars in 2016 versus Ford's 6.7 million. Tesla has returned to the public market for secondary offerings regularly since its 2010 IPO, most recently raising $1.5 billion to fuel production of the Model 3, despite never recording a profitable quarter. It does so because investors respond to Musk's vision. They buy into his story. This is a guy who says he's going to put rockets into space, revolutionize the car industry, and transform the power storage industry. Oh, and build hypersonic trains on evenings and weekends. What if you could go back and invest in Thomas Edison's ideas? Well, here's your chance. Tesla owners describe their purchase decisions in messianic terms and value the company's mission above the particulars of its product. But this isn't your hippie uncle's green brand. Tesla is also a luxury brand, and that combination is potent. Every other electric car looks like a Birkenstock. The Tesla looks like a Maserati. No other brand can simultaneously tell people you can afford a $100,000 car, you have great taste, and you care about the environment. Or, put another way, I'm awesome and you should definitely have sex with me. That means, even more than Apple, Tesla has the ability to hit the customer, gently, right smack in the groin. Don't bet on Tesla limiting itself to automobiles. It already is developing deep expertise in the capture, storage, and transport of electricity. It is putting self-driving auto technology on the road by the tens of thousands, while Google and Apple are still in the research park. These are technologies and skills that go beyond personal automobiles and hold the potential for early market leadership in other transport markets, in alternative power generation, and in other uses of electricity in the digital age. Still, there remain two big obstacles to Tesla in its race to the stable. First, it's not yet a global firm. The majority of its business is done in the United States. Second, Tesla doesn't have a ton of customers, so it doesn't possess data on individual behavior at scale yet. But its cars are data-collecting machines, so the challenge here is scale and execution, not the underlying capability. Uber. As I write this, around 2 million people drive for Uber, called driver partners, which is more than the total number of employees of Delta, United, FedEx, and UPS combined. Uber adds 50,000 or more drivers per month. The service is available in more than 81 countries and 581 cities, and it's winning in most of those markets. In Los Angeles, only 30% of ride-hailing trips were in taxis in 2016. In New York, almost the same number of cabs and Ubers are hailed daily, 327,000 versus 249,000. For many urban dwellers around the world, Uber has become their default transportation solution, the dominant brand in a space that was previously a hodgepodge of local operators and a penchant for yellow. These days, Uber is the first and last thing I spend money on in every city I visit. Imagine paying $100 every time you entered or left a city or country. That's the relationship the global business person, a very attractive segment, has with Uber, or Uber has with us. I get off the plane in Cannes, France, where I'm speaking at the Cannes Creativity Festival, the What Advertising Sucks Least Festival. There's the Uber app on my phone. I see Uber X, Uber Black, and something called Uber Copter. My finger dives to that Uber Copter button on my phone reflexively. Who wouldn't want to know what this is? I get a call 10 seconds later saying, "Meet me at baggage claim." They put me in a Mercedes van, drive me half a kilometer to a helipad. I get in a lawnmower with a propeller, piloted by a guy who looks like my paperboy in a pilot's Halloween costume, and for 120 euros, about 20 euros more than a cab, I'm choppered over the Côte d'Azur and set down 300 meters from my hotel. For a moment, I'm James Bond, minus the looks, skills, gadgets, sex appeal, Aston Martin, and License to Kill. Still, close. This is not only super cool, but possible, because Uber has access to visionary capital and has paired it with creativity and a lack of respect for the norms around customer experience. The company can do crazy shit like that. Decide to take everybody on a helicopter from an airport to a luxury hotel. Or deliver kittens on Valentine's Day. But it fails on vertical, as the cars are owned by the drivers, who often work with competitors. Not owning cars has helped them scale fast, but it makes them vulnerable, as they have no analog moats. As you might imagine, Uber also has considerable big data skills. It knows where you are, where you're going, where you're likely to go, and it's all linked to your identity. The app is already auto-populating your destination based on travel history, aging in reverse. Uber isn't known as much of an accelerant because very few people know anybody who works for Uber HQ. Uber only has a few thousand employees, and they're very technically literate. Uber has figured out a way to isolate the lords, 8,000 employees, from the serfs, 2 million drivers, who average $7.75 an hour. So its 4,000 employees can carve up $70 billion versus $2 million on an hourly wage. So Uber has said to the global workforce, in hushed but clear tones, thanks, and fuck you. Can a car service really justify Uber's $70 billion private market valuation? Doubtful. But Uber is more than just a car service. In fact, taxis are to Uber what books were to Amazon. It's a real business and one Uber can do quite well with. But it's only the camel's nose under the tent. The real prize is leveraging its massive driver network, and soon its massive self-driving car network. In California, Uber trialed Uber Fresh, a food delivery service. In Manhattan, it trialed Uber Rush, a package courier. In Washington, D.C., it started Uber Essentials, an online ordering and delivery service of grocery store essentials. The firm appears to be building a vascular, last-mile system for global business. That is, taking the blood of commerce to the organs of business globally. Getting Adam's stuff around is still a huge issue for firms and people. And Uber could be the equivalent of the transporter from Star Trek, only safer and cheaper, if a bit slower. It's likely that, without yet recognizing it, we are seeing a celebrity deathmatch take shape between Uber and Amazon for control of the last mile. Meanwhile, FedEx, UPS, and DHL are about to get a lesson in disruption. Uber checks almost every box in the T algorithm. Differentiated product, access to visionary capital, global reach, big data skills. That said, beyond execution, no small thing, Uber has only one obstacle, but it is a significant one, to getting to a $1 trillion valuation. Likeability. Uber faces challenges on this factor along two fronts. First, its CEO is an asshole, or at least he's perceived as an asshole. This fact gave rise to a few instances where consumers were encouraged to delete the app, and many did. Where the firm likely lost $10 billion plus in value in 48 hours was not the number of people who deleted the app, but the discovery of substitutes, as Uber isn't vertical, and Lyft was able to access many of the same drivers. It's not just the CEO throwing up on himself. In 2014, an Uber senior vice president suggested, in the presence of a journalist, that Uber hire opposition researchers to dig up dirt on journalists who wrote unflattering stories about the company. There have been a series of reports that Uber management uses the technology's ability to track riders in real time for entertainment or other personal reasons, including members of the press. In France, Uber ran an ad campaign that, at best, was sexist, and arguably suggested that Uber was a great way to hire an escort service. In 2016, Uber paid a $20,000 fine as part of an investigation by the New York Attorney General into the misuse of its tracking capability. Worst of all, Uber's likability took a major hit with Susan Fowler's corporate sexual discrimination charges in February 2017. Actions by mid-level and C-level management ranged from callous to reprehensible in dozens of instances. Scrappy startups can sometimes get away with this sort of thing, but industry giants are expected to display greater maturity. Heads should have rolled, and some did, if months later. In June 2017, despite recommendations by external counsel that sought to reallocate the responsibilities of Kalanick, the board initially didn't fire Kalanick. Instead, he announced he was taking an unlimited leave of absence. The leave of absence narrative showed poor judgment on the part of the board, letting a bad situation get worse. Under pressure from investors, Kalanick resigned the following week. He is clearly a gifted visionary who's built something world-changing. But as the firm enters a new stage, it needs a CEO with a new focus and crisis-proof management skills. Uber is now worth more than Volkswagen, Porsche, and Audi, and thousands of families and investors are reliant on the firm and its leadership. This is no longer about Travis, and the firm shouldn't have to see if his frat rock rehab takes effect or he relapses. Will this controversy hurt Uber? Yes, but there will be a lag, and not where you think. Consumers talk a big game about social responsibility, and then buy phones and little black dresses manufactured in factories where people kill themselves and pour mercury into the water. Uber has an outstanding product, and revenue growth will continue to accelerate. Where it hurts is in the distraction among management, costing them the ability to attract and retain the best talent, where the war is won or lost in a digital age. Beyond the PR and management crises, Uber's likability risk comes from a more fundamental place than management's bro behavior. Uber is undoubtedly a disruptor in the great tradition of Silicon Valley disruptors. Unfortunately for Uber, the market it's disrupting is a heavily regulated one, and Uber benefits greatly by its attitude that it is not subject to the same regulations as traditional taxis. It believes, and the market has rewarded this belief, that it can hire whomever it wants to drive, and it can charge whatever it wants. Meanwhile, its taxi competition has no such freedom in most markets. Nor does Uber necessarily play fair with its ride-sharing competitors, such as Lyft. There have been several reported incidents of Uber employees engaged in organized efforts to sabotage the competition by ordering and canceling rides from those competitors repeatedly. Something like a real-world denial-of-service attack. At an even broader level, Uber's business model has been attacked for undermining employment relationships and creating unstable, low-wage work that can dry up without recourse. The company maintains that it doesn't run a car service at all, but rather it provides an app that allows drivers to share their cars for a fee. This has raised a host of concerns about driver insurance and benefits, what sort of safety and security obligations Uber has, and other issues. Hence, the hashtag Delete Uber movement that sprung up in minutes in February 2017 and led to an estimated 200,000 Uber users quitting their account with the company over claims that Uber was trying to exploit users during a taxi strike at JFK Airport over protests of President Trump's immigration executive order. The claim was that Uber used the strike to market itself to desperate protesters stuck at the airport. That the story wasn't really true didn't matter. It was a glimpse into the disquiet even loyal users feel about Uber's methods. the world is still trying to figure out if Uber is good for us or not. Uber may be a glimpse into what the future looks like in a digital economy. Incredible apps providing a remarkable consumer experience subsidized by swooning investors. But also millions of low-paying jobs and a small segment of society splitting a Herculean windfall. Thousands of lords, millions of serfs. Walmart. Walmart may have let Amazon leap to an early lead in the race to be the dominant retailer of the digital age, but it's not out of the race yet. With nearly 12,000 stores in 28 countries, it generated more revenue than any other company in the world in 2015, as it has every year in this century. When the world was moving online, Walmart was starting to look like a dinosaur. But as companies are realizing that online commerce can only thrive long-term when it's embedded in a real-world infrastructure that includes stores, Walmart is still a force to be reckoned with. It has decades of experience managing tight inventories and efficient delivery systems. And its 12,000 stores can be 12,000 warehouses, 12,000 customer service centers, and 12,000 showrooms. Add in that some customers actually live in their RVs in Walmart parking lots, and you have a very interesting market advantage. In late 2016, Walmart acquired Jet.com for $3 billion, or $6.5 million per employee. Jet.com had no viable business model, needed to get to $20 billion in revenue to break even, and was spending $5 million a week on advertising when the deal went through. However, it has a horseman skill, storytelling. Dynamic pricing, as told by the founder of a firm acquired by Amazon, Quidsi, made Mark Lurie a potential savior. I believe Jet.com was the equivalent of $3 billion hair plugs purchased by a retailer in a full-blown midlife crisis. However, to be fair, the firm does seem to have gotten its groove back regarding e-commerce. Lurie has pushed for operational efficiency, price transparency, and savings via in-store pickup. We'll see. But Walmart seeking Botox is just the beginning. The firm has access to immense capital, but it's not cheap, as the firm trades at a multiple of profits, which is customary for a retail firm. When the Arkansan retailer announced earnings would take a hit, as they were rightfully increasing CapEx to compete with Amazon, the next day the firm shed the equivalent of Macy's from its market cap. In addition, Walmart is not very likable, as they are the largest employer in the world with more minimum wage workers than any other U.S. company, but also populate the wealthiest people in the world list with a host of Walton kids, who are worth more than the bottom 40% of American households. Finally, if you ever wondered who are the people in households that don't own a smartphone or have broadband, look no further. It's the Walmart shopper. The term late adopter defines Walmart shoppers. Digital programming and innovation gets less traction with this cohort. Microsoft. Microsoft is no longer the beast of Redmond, the company that utterly dominated the PC era. But Windows still powers 90% of the installed basis of desktop computers, even if half of those are still creaking along with Windows 7. Office remains the world's default productivity suite, and professional products such as SQL Server and Visual Studio are ubiquitous. If it hadn't so badly failed with its Windows phone, Microsoft would most likely already be the fifth horseman, and perhaps still the most powerful company on Earth. If it can manage to grow LinkedIn without crushing it in its embrace, Microsoft may still have a chance. In addition, it has found elusive growth with its cloud offering, Azure. This, coupled with a youthful new CEO, has breathed new life into the Microsoft story. It is no longer the accelerant it used to be, but its focus on the enterprise versus consumer for the four gives it a marketplace that hasn't seen the same level of innovation or competition as consumer tech. And its other growth story? LinkedIn. The professional counterpart to Facebook, LinkedIn has some important and tangible advantages compared with its big social counterpart. Facebook gets the bulk of its revenues from one source, advertising. By comparison, LinkedIn has three distinct sources of revenues. It sells advertising on its site, charges recruiters for upgraded access to candidates, and sells users premium subscriptions with benefits for job hunting and business development. That's balance. These subscription revenue sources make LinkedIn unique not only with respect to Facebook, but every other major social media player. LinkedIn also faces an enviable competitive landscape. It has no true competitor. There are niche sites for specific professions, and Facebook itself represents potential competition, but nobody is offering anything like LinkedIn's broad coverage of employment and business networking. You may trade off Facebook for Instagram, Instagram for WeChat, WeChat for Twitter, etc. However, in the B2B world, you are posting your CV on one platform, and that's LinkedIn. You get pissed off at LinkedIn or you decide it's not cool. Where do you go? Nowhere. LinkedIn stands alone. It's one of one right now, with no obvious new competition on the horizon. LinkedIn, by the nature of its business, also has an enviable customer base. More than 467 million people are on LinkedIn, and not just any 400 million. Composed of savvy college grads looking to show off their qualifications and business leaders from around the world, one out of every three people have a LinkedIn profile. So, to the question, who's on LinkedIn? The answer is anyone who matters. There is a small sliver of baby boomer CEOs who aren't on LinkedIn because they are worried they'll be harassed by job seekers or they are still trying to figure out their Motorola Razr phone. Other than them, the LinkedIn cohort is global and encompassing. By the way, the market for advertising in B2B is twice that of B2C, so the addressable market for LinkedIn is greater than for all the B2C social platforms. The trade-off facing LinkedIn, however, is that with focus comes limits. LinkedIn is successful because it serves a relatively narrow market with a relatively narrow set of services. Being the world's directory for professionals is a big business, but it can only be the beginning for a company with aspirations of horseman status. How LinkedIn builds on that platform is now up to Microsoft. The potential for integration with Outlook and Microsoft's other productivity apps is compelling, not to mention Windows and Microsoft's long struggling efforts in mobile. But those opportunities may also doom any ambitions LinkedIn has to be a dominant force on its own, since its fortunes are now going to be evaluated based on its ability to drive Microsoft's bottom line. And, for 20 years, that has meant maintaining the omnipresence of Windows and Office at the expense of everything else. So, the biggest challenge for LinkedIn to reach horseman status is that while the firm checks all the boxes, it checks them in pencil, not ink. Its product is good, but not as good as Facebook. It has access to visionary capital, but not at the same low price as Amazon. And now it's owned by a company that is resurgent, but after more than a decade of decline. In sum, LinkedIn is the Bruce Jenner of this analysis, a great athlete who did a lot of things well. After all, Bruce won an Olympic gold medal for the decathlon and was on the box of the Wheaties I ate in elementary school. Sorry, Caitlin, you'll always be Bruce to me. But Jenner was never a gold medalist in any of those individual sports. He was, to use an old phrase, a Jack, now Jill, of all trades, but master of none. Airbnb. It would be tempting to say Airbnb is the Uber for hotels and move to the next candidate. However, there are stark differences that illuminate Airbnb's competitive strength relative to Uber and how the T algorithm can be used to influence strategy and capital allocation. While they both are global and enjoy access to cheap capital, their product has substantially different variants. NYU Stern Professor of Management Sonia Marciano, clearest blue flame thinker and strategy today, believes the key to establishing advantage is finding points of differentiation where there is large, real or perceived, variance. If you're a decathlete, the key is to find the event with the greatest variance in performance and own it. Uber is a great product, but I'd challenge you to identify, without knowing which ride-sharing platform you booked through, the difference between Uber, Lyft, Curb, and Titi Shuxing. The category is a 10-time improvement over cabs and black cars, but there is an increasing sameness among ride-sharing players. This has likely been the case for a while, but Uber's CEO frat rock, that is, shit for brains, behavior, has prompted people to discover on their own that Lyft is the same thing. The Airbnb platform takes on greater importance as an arbiter of trust, as there is greater variance in the product. A houseboat in Marin versus a townhouse in South Kensington. United Airlines has more differentiation than Uber right now, but as they can drag someone off a plane, due to their fuck-up, if you need to get from San Francisco to Denver, United Hubs, you're going to forgive, because that United flight is highly differentiated. Only choice. In addition, Airbnb has another moat regarding product. Specifically, the liquidity of their product. Liquidity translates to having enough suppliers and customers who can be matched to make the service viable. Both have achieved this. However, the liquidity Airbnb has garnered is more impressive and harder to replicate. Uber needs a mess of drivers and people looking for rides to build a business in a city. Uber's cash hoard gives them the ability to ramp up a city, as can other ride-hailing firms with sufficient capital. However, Airbnb needed to achieve a critical mass of supply in one city and demand awareness in many others. People visit Amsterdam from all over the world. There is competition for Uber in every major city, as a firm only needs to establish liquidity in one market. Airbnb needed and reached scale on a continental and then global level. Airbnb's and Uber's valuations, at the time of this writing, are $25 billion and $70 billion respectively. However, I believe Airbnb will surpass Uber's value by the end of 2018, and Uber will register the mother of all write-downs as word spreads regarding their lack of product differentiation and regional competitors take an awful income statement, $3 billion in losses on $5 billion in revenues in 2016, and make it worse. Airbnb is the most likely sharing unicorn to become the fifth horseman. Their weakest point is their lack of vertical integration. They don't own any apartments, meaning Airbnb doesn't have the same degree of control over the customer experience as the four. This warrants a hard look by Airbnb management at allocating some of that cheap capital toward greater control of the channel, long-term exclusives with properties, and consistent amenities, wireless, docking stations, local concierge in each metro, etc. IBM. Before Google, before Microsoft, before some of the listeners of this program were even born, there was one company that mattered in tech. Big Blue was technology, the de facto standard for corporate America and, after joining with Intel and Microsoft, the dominant firm of the first quarter century of personal computers. But IBM isn't on this list for nostalgia purposes. even as its revenues continue the long, slow decline from their majestic heights, 19 straight quarters of declining revenues as of Q1 2017, the company still recorded $80 billion in revenue in 2016. And every year the mix shifts from legacy computer hardware toward high-margin services and recurring relationships. IBM's vaunted sales force can still get meetings with every Fortune 500 CTO. And the company is a serious player in the race to get corporate America into the cloud. IBM has a new, more handsome lead character in their story, Watson. The firm is global and arguably vertical. However, the movement up the food chain to services puts them in a business that trades at a multiple of EBITDA versus revenues, limiting access to cheap capital. And they are seen as a safe place to get a job versus inspiring. The kids at IBM are the ones who got second-round interviews at Google but didn't get an offer. IBM is no longer seen as the career accelerant it once was. Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, Time Warner. This book assumes you are online. And who almost certainly owns the line you are on? One of these four companies. Cable and telco lines were one of the great legal monopolies of the 20th century. And the big four companies to have emerged from decades of mergers are essential players in the digital age. They face some major obstacles to taking advantage of their position, however. In particular, most people hate them, and they have no clear path to global status, as local telcos are a source of national identity, and governments are pesky about other nations listening in on their phone calls and data. That said, everyone hated the railroads too, and canal boat companies, and stagecoach firms. As Lily Tomlin, as Ernestine, the phone operator, used to say, "We don't care, we don't have to. We're the phone company." If you own the pipes on which the world's data travels, you are always going to be important, highly profitable, and very big. That doesn't fulfill many of our criteria for being a horseman, but it may be enough to get you close. After that, all it would take would be an outbreak of enlightened management and to be viewed as an accelerant. Unlikely, but still possible. Could any of these companies become the fifth horseman? And would the four horsemen allow it to happen? Surely Amazon is never going to let Walmart take back all of the ground the younger company has captured. And Google, as it pursues autonomous vehicles, is surely aware of Uber and Tesla. But there is no accounting for the twists and turns of history. In 1970, IBM seemed unstoppable. In 1990, Microsoft made the electronics industry quake in terror. Companies grow older. Success breeds complacency. And the departure of top talent in search of new challenges and pre-IPO options on equity is inevitable. And of course, there is the wild card. Right now, in some lab or dorm room, someone is working on a new technology that will turn the digital world upside down. Just as the transistor did in 1947 and the integrated circuit did in 1958. Elsewhere, at some kitchen table or a booth at Starbucks, a startup team led by the next Steve Jobs is plotting a new enterprise that could streak past the horsemen to become the first 1T corporation. It's not likely, but it never is. Like 100-year floods that seem to be happening every 10 years, it seems impossible until it isn't. Chapter 10. The Four and You. The dominance of the four has an outsized effect on the competitive landscape and the lives of consumers. But what is their impact on the average career path of the educated individual? I'd argue no young person today should be ignorant of the four and how they've reshaped the economy. They've made it harder for middle-of-the-road companies to succeed, or for any consumer-facing tech startup to compete and survive. Given that most of us, and statistics support me on this, are average, what can we learn to help us make the jump from good to strong, even great? I close the book with some observations on what a successful career strategy looks like in this brave new world. Success and the insecurity economy. In sum, it's never been a better time to be exceptional, or a worse time to be average. That's one of the major effects of the disruptive environment created by the rise of the lottery economy, wherein digital technology creates a single market in which one leader can capture the overwhelming majority of gains. A series of discrete pawns, businesses, and geographies are in the midst of the downpour of globalization, making a smaller number of really big lakes. The bad news? There are more predators. The good news, the big fish in the big pond has a fat life. The four horsemen demonstrate this on a mega scale. There is a marketplace corollary to this phenomenon where the value of the top-tier products in a category explodes even as the value of lesser products collapses. In rare books, Amazon has given once obscure and hard-to-find editions global exposure. Predictably, the resulting increase in demand for a fixed supply has led to higher prices, for the finest masterworks, but it has also illuminated the abundance of run-of-the-mill books, and given the buyer exponentially more choices below the top tier, which, just as predictably, has had the opposite effect, crushing the value of these non-top-tier books. The same thing is happening in labor markets. Thanks to LinkedIn, everyone is on the global job market all the time. If you are exceptional, there are thousands of firms looking for, and finding, you. If you are good, you are now competing with tens of millions of other good candidates all over the planet. And your wages may stagnate or decline. The top dozen professors at Stern are in demand globally, and get paid $50,000 or more to speak at a lunch. I'd venture their average annual income is $1 million to $3 million. The rest, good, are now competing with Khan Academy and the University of Adelaide. Both offer good, the former online. These good professors teach executive education for modest extra income, or complain about the dean in a primal scream for relevance as they make a fraction of what their marginally better colleagues make. The difference between good and great can be 10% or less, but the delta in rewards is closer to 10 times. The good professor's average annual income is $120,000 to $300,000, and they are overpaid and easily replaced. The university can't fire them thanks to tenure, so it pretends to be concerned and mostly ignores them. It makes them department chairs, assigns them to committees, and comes up with a host of excuses for their mediocrity. So, if not naturally great, what behaviors help achieve the extra 10%? The fundamentals won't change. Excellence, grit, and empathy are timeless attributes of successful people in every field. But as the pace and variability of work increase, success will be at the margins, separating successful people from the herd. As I described at the beginning of this book, my sixth company is L2, a business intelligence, fancy term for research, firm, that has grown to 140 people in 7 years. 70% of our employees are under 30. The average age is 28. L2 employees are often recruited by aspirational firms. They are kids, raw, having had little time to shape their working personalities beyond the nature and the nurture of their youth. It's an interesting environment to observe people and witness how their core personalities drive success and failure. And from those observations, I've come to some conclusions regarding what it takes to succeed in our evolving, horseman-driven economy. Personal success factors. On average, Smart people who work hard and treat people well do better than people whose thinking is muddled, who are lazy, or who are unpleasant to colleagues. That has always been and will always be true, even if the occasional jerk proves the exception. However, talent and hard work only get you in the top billion on the planet. There are other, more subtle centrifuges and separators that create the cream of the digital age. Nothing is more important than emotional maturity, especially for people in their 20s, in whom this quality can vary widely. There are fewer and fewer fields in which a person reports to work with a single boss, a specific set of tasks, and the expectation that those parameters won't change frequently or significantly. By comparison, the digital age worker must often respond to numerous stakeholders and shift between roles throughout the day, an environment that favors the mature. And as competitive and product cycles shorten, our work life will see rapid swings between success and failure. How well someone manages their own enthusiasm through those cycles is important. How people interact with one another determines the projects they work on, who will work with them, and who wants to hire them. Young people who have a strong sense of their own identity remain poised under stress and learn and apply what they've learned, do better than peers who are more easily flustered, get hung up on petty issues, and let their emotions drive their responses to stimuli. People who are comfortable taking direction and giving it, and who understand their role in a group, do better than their peers when lines of authority get murky and organizational structures are fluid. This effect has been well documented in the academic environment. A massive meta-study of 668 evaluative studies of school programs teaching social and emotional life skills found that 50% of children in those programs increased their scholastic achievement. And there were similarly dramatic drops in misbehavior. And best-selling author Daniel Goleman, who popularized the term emotional intelligence, found measurable business results at global companies led by individuals who demonstrate self-awareness, self-regulation, motivation, empathy, and social skills. One interesting result of the increasing importance of emotional maturity is that among younger people, this skill favors women. I'm not trying to be politically correct here, though admittedly, I'm not sure I would have had the balls to highlight this point if the finding favored men. Anyway, when asked in surveys, men and women agree that women in their 20s tend to act their age more than men. There is neurological evidence that women's brains develop sooner and more quickly into adult brains. I often attend meetings where a young man, or several, burn up most of the time expounding on their own enthusiasms, clash over perceived control of the dialogue, and generally preen before the crowd until finally a young woman in the room, who has kept her mouth shut and listened, calmly introduces relevant facts, summarizes the critical issues, and makes the recommendation that gets us on to our next task. Men, even young men, still enjoy a cultural bias over their female peers when it comes to advancement, probably because they are seen as more decisive. This will likely remain the case for that minority of young men who cultivate emotional maturity. But they will be a rare and valuable breed. Firms have figured out that, with 70% of high school valedictorians female, the future really is women. The digital age is Heraclitus on steroids. Change is a daily constant. In almost every professional environment, we are expected to use and master tools that did not exist a decade ago, or even last year. For better or worse, and frankly, it is often for worse, organizations have access, essentially, to infinite amounts of data, and what might as well be an infinite variety of ways to sort through and act on that data. At the same time, ideas can be turned into reality at unprecedented speed. The thing Amazon, Facebook, and no less hot firms, including Zara, have in common is they are agile, the new economy term for fast. Curiosity is crucial to success. What worked yesterday is out of date today and forgotten tomorrow, replaced by a new tool or technique we haven't yet heard of. Consider that the telephone took 75 years to reach 50 million users, whereas television was in 50 million households within 13 years, the internet in 4, and Angry Birds in 35 days. In the tech era, the pace is accelerating further. It took Microsoft Office 22 years to reach a billion users, but Gmail only 12, and Facebook 9. Trying to resist this tide of change will drown you. Successful people in the digital age are those who go to work every day, not dreading the next change, but asking, "What if we did it this way?" Adherence to process, or how we've always done it, is the Achilles heel of big firms, and sepsis for careers. Be the gal who comes up with practical and batshit crazy ideas worth discussing and trying. Play offense. For every 4 things you're asked to do, offer 1 deliverable or idea that was not asked for. Another standout skill is ownership. Be more obsessed with the details than anybody on your team and what needs to get done, if, when, and how. Assume nothing will happen unless you are all over everybody and everything, as it likely won't. Be an owner in every sense of the word. Your task, your project, your business. You own it. Go to college. Yeah, I know, no shit. Still, it bears repeating. If you want to be a white-collar success in the digital age, the clearest signal is attendance at a prestigious undergraduate school. And the distinction matters. Yes, Zuckerberg, Gates, and Jobs all dropped out of college. However, you or your son are not Mark Zuckerberg. And while none of them graduated, their college experiences were still instrumental in their success. Facebook went viral among college students because it grew out of a real need on campus. Gates spent 3 years intensely studying math and programming at Harvard before he started Microsoft. And he met Steve Ballmer there, the man to whom he'd turn over the reins of Microsoft a quarter century later. And even Jobs, who passed through Reed College in an adolescent days, famously had his passion for design sparked there. All the bullshit, cost, and stress parents endure to get and keep their kids on the path to a decent 4-year school is still very much worth it. College grads make 10 times more over their lifetime than people with just high school degrees. There are precious few places in the world and times in our life when we are put in the simultaneous presence of eager and bright young minds, brilliant thinkers, and the luxury of time to mature and generally ponder the opportunities set forth by the universe. So go to college. You may even learn something. But even if you don't, a brand name college on your forehead will be your greatest asset until you have assets. And it will never stop opening doors. HR departments, graduate program, admissions committees, and even potential mates are busy people with lots of options. We all need filtering mechanisms and simple rules of thumb to wade through our choices. And it's just too easy to think Yale equals smart, U of nowhere equals not as smart. And in a digital age, smart is sexy. No one likes to admit it, but the United States has a caste system. It's called college. At the height of the Great Recession, unemployment among college grads was less than 5%. While those with only high school diplomas suffered unemployment rates above 15%, and your degree of success is stratified based on the college you attend. The kids who get into the top 20 schools are fine. They can pay off their student debt. Meanwhile, everybody else incurs the same level of student debt, yet faces nowhere near the same opportunities for an ROI on that debt. The cost of college has skyrocketed in recent years. At a rate of 197% versus the 1.37% inflation rate. Education is ripe for disruption. There's a commonly believed fallacy right now that technology companies, specifically VC-backed technology education companies, are going to disrupt education. That's bullshit. Instead, Harvard, Yale, MIT, and Stanford are the favorites to disrupt education when they fall under heavy and sustained government pressure over the irrational and immoral hoarding of their mammoth endowments. Harvard claims it could have doubled the size of its freshman class last year with no sacrifice to its educational quality. Good. Do it. More students paying no tuition at the best schools will disrupt the system. Not massive open online campuses, MOOCs at mediocre colleges. Remember Apple chapter? Hope they do it. At a top university, the brand isn't the only thing that you'll get besides your education. The friends you make on campus can be just as valuable. Some of those friends will drop off the face of the earth, sure, but some of them will go on to acquire assets or skills or connections of their own that, properly networked, may be just what you need to succeed in your own future endeavors. Some of my most trusted advisors and business partners are people I met at UCLA, and later at Haas. I know I would not have had the success I've had without those experiences and friendships. The problem with this advice, and I'll be the first to admit it, is that it's unfair. The cost of college is ruinously expensive. 4 years tuition plus room and board at even a second-tier school can run you $250,000. And though many top-tier schools can offer generous financial aid packages, financial aid at Ivy League schools, for example, is already so substantial that kids from average-income households already get not only free tuition, they get free room and board. It often isn't tuition that keeps bright, poor kids out of the best schools. To take advantage of these programs, those bright, poor kids have to get admitted, and that means competing with kids who've had private tutors, SAT prep classes, and every field trip imaginable. They also have to compete against legacies.